Our guest today is Dr. Peter Bregan. And this gentleman here, I guess I want to say, has gone out on a limb about as far as a medical doctor and a psychiatrist can go. And what I mean by that is, you know, you have to almost buck the system in order to get information out that's important information, information that he's an expert in and has a considerable amount of background and research in. So don't touch the dial, because everything that we talk about today in some way, shape, or form affects you and probably somebody that you know. If it doesn't directly affect you, I can guarantee that it affects someone that you know or someone close by. Dr. Bregan, welcome to this radio show, and I'm glad you're here, because the subject material that you are, I guess I want to say, so versed in, is something that just doesn't get a whole lot of air as far as the media is concerned.
Well, you're sure right about that, Ted. When you criticize psychiatric drugs or electroshock treatment or involuntary psychiatric treatment, the system not only has to be bucked, the system fights back. The system attacks. And if you do as I've done, which is to go up against the drug companies, for example, I've been an expert in many product liability suits where I go inside Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, or I go inside the records of GlaxoSmithKline, the manufacturer of Paxil. They really don't like that. And I've defined the problem as the psychopharmaceutical complex. The funding source for the complex, the psychopharmaceutical complex, is, of course, the drug companies, who then work with the government agencies like the NIMH and the FDA. They influence the medical schools. They influence the insurance companies. They practically write many of the journals. They pay for the journals to be published. They even, in several cases, pay for the journals to be distributed free to the doctors. The drug companies pay for much of the conferences that the medical associations, including the American Psychiatric Association, carry out. So basically now we have this giant complex devoted to the single task of convincing Americans and now people throughout the world that they have biochemical disorders like depression and anxiety and OCD and ADHD and so on that can only be treated by psychiatric drugs. And they've actually created a myth, because there are no such biochemical imbalances, and it's one of the giant successes in PR in the history of the world is the psychopharmaceutical complex convincing people that they have brain disorders and biochemical disorders and they need to take psychiatric drugs.
Well, let me stop for just for a second, and let's talk a little bit about your background. And what is it that originally sparked your interest in the medical profession?
Well, when I went to college, I had no plan at all to become a physician. I thought I'd be a professor of American history and literature. I was in an honors program for history and literature at Harvard College. And during my first year, a friend came by and said, we've just started a new volunteer program at the local state mental hospital. Why don't you come out there? And when I walked into the state mental hospital, I was just overwhelmed with the horror of it. The year was 1954. The new lobotomizing psychiatric drugs were not quite in this hospital yet. They'd be there shortly. And the hospital reminded me, above all else, of my Uncle Dutch's description of liberating an extermination camp. People were crowded into dungeons. They were often emaciated. They were being brutalized by the AIDS. They'd been lobotomized, electroshocked, and drugged with all kinds of toxic agents. They'd been strapped into tubs. They'd been given insulin coma, this horrible thing where you inject patients with insulin and it knocks them into a coma because they don't have any blood sugar for their brain. And you kill brain cells, and then the patient awakens, and all of a sudden is grateful, independent, and helpless. It was clear to me as a college kid, 18 years old, with untrained eyes, that this was brutality. This wasn't treatment, that it was worse than nothing, that if I were locked up in a place like that, I would go insane within a short period of time. And just overall, that there, but for the grace of God, go I. I really, in retrospect, for whatever reason, had a profound empathy with what the people were going through. So, Ted, we set up, in addition to doing things like cleaning the wards, you know, and painting wards and taking people to dances, under my direction, we set up a group of students, about 15 of us, to work with individual patients. It freaked out the director, but he finally came around, agreed, and gave us a social worker to supervise us. And, oh, my gosh, the medical establishment, the psychoanalysts, they thought this was horrible. These college students working with their individual, quote, back ward patients, these very disturbed and chronic patients. And we befriended them. We took them seriously, our patients. We cared about them. And to everyone's surprise, we got nearly every one of them out of the hospital. So it became clear to me as a youngster that people needed other people, not lobotomies and drugs and incarceration. They needed caring. I co-authored my first book out of the program as a youngster and gave lectures around the country. So it was very clear to me early on that this human distress I was seeing was the product of people's lives, that it could happen to anyone, that what happened to them at the hands of psychiatry was akin literally to Nazi Germany in terms of how bad the hospitals were, how many people were killed each year and died each year in the hospitals. So I came into the field. I decided to go to medical school. I went into the field as a reformer. But ironically, Ted, the profession would get worse and worse. Because when I was a student, at least there was room for the psychosocial program. I could work with Harvard professors as a youngster on psychosocial volunteer programs. But as the profession realized it had to go totally medical, or else social workers and psychologists and family therapists would get all the business, that they had to say that everything was medical. Nowadays, you couldn't have that kind of volunteer program because it undermines the whole brain disorder concept.
Just out of curiosity, of the people that were institutionalized in the institution you were volunteering in, how many of those people do you believe, or maybe a percentage, were possibly normal and just herded into this place by means of force or labeling or the legalities of it?
Well, probably at least half the people in there were either simply very poor, because the main characteristics of the people in the old state mental hospitals was poverty, or they were old. 11 major characteristics were people, you know, who were abandoned because they were elderly and too much difficulty. And many of them were chronically ill. So you've got a huge percentage, certainly more than half of these people, who just needed some kindness, some decent medical care, maybe a place to stay because they were elderly or ill. None of them needed to be in this situation. Now, of the people who were traditionally more of what we think of as mentally ill, a word I don't use, the people who were labeled schizophrenic and had at one time or another been acutely depressed or acutely psychotic, that group of people, all of them could have been better served by decent human services, therapy, family therapy, help in the home, and none of them would have needed to end up there. And we have these programs now around the world that have demonstrated that if you just really help somebody in the middle of their first psychotic episode, they don't even stay crazy long enough to get labeled schizophrenic, because you got to be 6 months for that to happen. So the whole system was just a corruption, the whole system.
Well, what followed that? You did the volunteer work there, and as you observed these people, it kind of plucked your heartstrings, and some kind of a resonance took place there, and you decided that, you know, that there was a need and you wanted to fill that need. So what was the next step? How did you progress from there?
Well, I went on to medical school, much to my surprise. I went to Case Western Reserve Medical School, which is one of the best in the country, and at the time was the one of the few schools where you could actually do a research thesis during your 4 years, which I did. And at that time, I began to see that things were not going well, that psychiatry was, if anything, getting worse and worse, that it was, unlike every other section in the medical school, it was self-righteous, know-it-all, and acted like it had the answers, whereas even the anatomists were raising more challenging questions about what we know about anatomy than the psychiatrists were raising about what we know about human beings and their suffering. So I realized even more so how bizarrely arrogant and out of touch with reality the profession was, and that the medical docs and the surgeons were actually much more grounded in reality and often really looked down their noses at psychiatry. But I was a good student. I went on and I went to Harvard, and at that point, the Harvard training program took a political turn. It was quite incredible. People think that the changes we see in psychiatry with all the drugs and the emphasis on the biological model, that's science. It was political. When I applied to the Harvard training program, it was oriented around psychology and social change and around family therapy and individual therapy. And when I entered the program 1 year later, they'd made a political change. They'd fired the psychoanalyst. They'd limited the amount of, not that psychoanalysis was anything great, but a lot of people who did it were good therapists. They literally wouldn't let you see too many patients in therapy anymore, and they wanted you to drug everybody and learn to manage a ward. And that was just a political change to go with the flow of where the money and power was going to be, because psychiatry realized that they couldn't compete anymore with psychologists and social workers doing therapy, so, you know, because they would charge less and do a better job, the psychologists and social workers and family therapists. So psychiatry just said, well, we're going to make everything medical, and we'll even if you're going to see a psychologist for therapy, you need to come see us for your drugs. And it was a political change. I then went on to the National Institute of Mental Health when I finished my training, and I, you know, still at the top of the profession. They didn't realize I'd been critical, but I didn't yet have a target on my back. And at the National Institute of Mental Health, when I was there, it was the last year or two when people were concerned about the psychological and social aspects of emotional well-being and the economic aspects of it, the realization that poverty was one of the biggest factors of all in being emotionally disturbed and disabled, and then also looking at family dynamics and as well as community services. Well, that came to an end because there wasn't money there and there wasn't power there. And by the time I left, NIMH was going through a transformation into a biological institute that was an arm, literally, of the pharmaceutical industry. So now I'm finished, I'm in practice, and I'm looking around, I'm thinking, gee, I'd hope to be the youngest professor at Harvard and the youngest head director of the American Psychiatric Association, and all I'm looking at is people who don't know anything about life, don't care anything about people, and are selling drugs. They're drug company representatives, basically. And I decided to go into private practice, which I'd never anticipated, and to teach at a university rather than a medical school, which I started to do. But then was the key, Ted. I found out lobotomy was coming back. It was 1971-72, and I found out there was a massive international resurgence of lobotomy, and I said, well, I can't just stay in private practice. And I started to do reform work. And over the next 4 or 5 years, I shut down basically almost all, but one or two, really two, of the American projects, went to Europe. Most of the projects there closed down. In Canada, they closed down. So I ran this really successful campaign. I set up an organization and was shocked, though. And I'll end with this, and we can go further with my background if you want, but I was shocked to find out that universally, totally, the medical establishment wanted to destroy this young psychiatrist because he was daring to go public and say lobotomy was unscientific and unethical. Unscientific and unethical. That I was willing to stand up in the print and get in all the newspapers and be on radio and TV and go to conferences and say these things, I was greeted with huge assault, particularly from the American Psychiatric Association, of which I was a member. And I realized this is why this we had state mental hospitals, lobotomy, shock treatment. Everybody's afraid to stand up. Any bright young person with a reformed spirit's going to get crushed. Well, I decided I wasn't going to get crushed, and that was the beginning of my taking on what would I would later define as the psychopharmaceutical complex.
Well, let me ask you a question. What was it that lobotomy was supposed to accomplish? What was it slated to do?
Well, you know, if you actually look at what they were saying, all they would talk about was the patient had 5 less of 30 symptoms or 2 less of 10 symptoms. They never had a formulation. They literally would only give you a one-line vignette or a chart of 20 patients, you know, with their perception of symptom reduction by the doctors without any real science at all, no controlled clinical trials or anything like that. But if you looked more deeply into the surgeons who really were interested in what they were doing, you find that they all agreed that what lobotomy did that was, quote, helpful was it produced apathy and indifference. The patient no longer cared about what was going on in their lives. The patient became robotic. And that's what you'd expect from mutilating, literally mutilating and destroying the highest centers of the brain. There's a reduction in the level of human experience. A very poignant illustration, there was a book by a fellow named Tao, who favored, T-O-W, who favored this lobotomy. But he described how before lobotomy, you would ask a patient to write an autobiography, and they'd write a lengthy note about the suffering they'd been through, the pain they'd been through, and what they'd experienced, and their suffering, and their ambivalence. They'd write a human history. They had a sense of themselves as humans. After, when you asked them to write an autobiography, they would either say, I can't, or they would write something very simplistic, like, my name is Joey George, and I live at 105th Street in Manhattan or whatever, and just give a little 3 lines of concrete. They really, people lost their personhood and their identity, but they became passive and helpless, submissive, and as that same book said, more easily controlled in a structured environment. It's tragic. It's evil.
Well, what we have today, though, and you know, we'll go down this road a little bit here, but I mean, is this not what we have today? Is the medical profession now not providing chemical lobotomies to people?
Well, if we start with the antipsychotic drugs, all of them that have any effect, and pretty much all of them, except for clozapine, which poisons in a different way, but all of the new drugs, Seroquel, Risperdal, Zyprexa, Abilify, they all suppress the function of a neurotransmitter system called dopamine. Now, if you just make a simple diagram, slice sideways of the human brain, you get a very clear picture of the dopamine pathways. They have the main pathways from deeper in the brain to the frontal lobes and limbic system. The frontal lobes are where thinking, thought, planning, creativity, loving, hating, all the human activities take place. And the limbic system, which wraps around it, is a little lower into the brain, is all about the emotions we feel. So you're blunting you're blunting that whole system of dopamine and therefore producing a direct, unequivocal chemical lobotomy. which we are now learning over time may become irreversible over years of exposure to these toxins. So if you start with the antipsychotic drugs, it's clear they're causing a lobotomy. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was so opposed by the establishment, almost really uniformly by the establishment, when I attacked lobotomy. Because that's the model for psychiatric treatment. It's lobotomy, whether it's electrical with electroshock, or whether it's, by the way, those are my dogs barking in the background. Can you hear my Shetland sheepdogs?
Yeah, I can just barely hear them.
Yeah, they've decided I'm at home today, and I don't mind having this on the air. My two dogs participate actively with me in therapy, and right now they're protecting the house from a squirrel, I'm sure. So the whole model for psychiatric treatment is brain destruction, it's lobotomy, and lobotomy produces apathy and indifference and makes you more submissive, and that's exactly what all the antipsychotic drugs do. And anybody who's familiar with them knows that you can raise the dose high enough to literally produce somebody who looks robotic. They're stiff, they can't move, their faces don't have expression, they can barely answer questions, except at a slowed down rate, very robotic. So now the question is, what about all the other drugs? They don't all cut into dopamine, but all psychiatric drugs disrupt brain function.
Well, let me ask you a question, and I know we're going to go down this road, but I want to ask you this first. Of your years in private practice, what has been the common denominators? In other words, the purpose of psychiatry is to, and everything that I know, is to help people get past situations that they necessarily can't manage on their own, where they need guidance, they need to be led, and they need to be able to, externalize what's internal. Maybe that's a that's my understanding, you know. And by doing that, they tend to work through problems and get things worked out. And a psychiatrist who understands all the various phases of human thinking and all that goes into the operation of the brain from a physical standpoint all the way out into a spiritual standpoint is the fellow that kind of leads and guides this process. So my question is, as a psychiatrist in private practice, what's been the common denominators? What do you see as the epidemic problems with I guess the general public?
Well, first, I can't quite answer your question yet, because like most folks, you're not describing psychiatry when you're describing psychiatry. You're describing good psychotherapy. You gave a nice description of good psychotherapy. Psychiatrists aren't even trained in psychotherapy. They don't read any books about, if you've read three self-help books, you know more about psychology than a psychiatrist, because they never read self-help books. They don't read anything except their own stuff. And their own stuff is fake science, claiming that depression requires this drug, ADHD requires that drug. It's about diagnosis and drugging. So what you described is what I do on a daily basis. Psychiatry does none of that. That is now the province of well-trained social workers, psychologists, counselors, ministers who have counseling training, family therapists, and people like that. You can't go to a psychiatrist today and expect help dealing with your current situation, understanding your life, putting together a better psychological, spiritual outlook. They wouldn't know what you were talking about. They're a bunch of very grim, somewhat emotionally alienated people giving diagnoses and drugs. That's the sad truth.
Now, when these guys go in, like, for example, now, doctors are required attend so many seminars or get so much school hours or whatever per year to maintain certifications and all that kind of stuff. Is it true that at this point in time that most of that educational process is now controlled and sponsored by the drug companies.
Absolutely. Whether you are getting it offline or your study credits or from a journal or if you're going to the Psychiatric Association meetings, and the vast majority of it is sponsored by drug companies. And those that aren't are still going to kowtow to the drug companies, or they'll get fired from the CME credit people. So the whole there's a lockdown that keeps out the psychotherapeutic and family and counseling approaches. There are a lot of people doing good therapy, but a very few of them are psychiatrists, and most of them are going to be older psychiatrists who learned therapy literally in the 1960s or 70s, maybe, but mostly 50s and 60s. That's how far back we're talking about. You've got to be an elderly gentleman in psychiatry now to know how to do therapy.
When you talked earlier, you talked about the fact that a lot of the drugs, majority of the drugs, all the drugs, are prescribed, but the need for these drugs have been defined by, I'm assuming, drug companies. And they talk about the imbalance, you know, in the brain. And there's this chemical imbalance, you know. And I asked some questions one time, and when I really got down to the nitty-gritty, being an engineer, the doctor finally admitted, well, we really don't know what these drugs do. We really don't know, but we think that this is what's going on. And he had a picture of a nerve and this serotonin molecule or whatever, and this is supposed to do this and that, you know. And I thought, well, wait a minute. What you're saying is you don't really, for sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt, know. And I said, well, is there any way to draw blood and verify this imbalance in the brain? And he wouldn't even answer the question. I couldn't get a straight answer out of the guy. And I thought, well, if you can't verify it empirically, how can you prescribe a chemical to compensate something that you can't even verify is going on?
Bob, yes, you're totally right. Anybody who's ever pinned down a psychiatrist on these issues notices they look like a worm on a hook. There is no evidence that anyone who routinely goes to a psychiatrist's office has a biochemical imbalance in the brain. No evidence whatsoever. But the moment you get a psychiatric drug, ironically, you now have a severe biochemical imbalance in your brain. That's how much we have a double think. It's actually the reverse. The brain is normal in patients who have emotional disturbances, upsets, conflicts, and things like that until they get a psychiatric drug or shock treatment, after which their brain is injured, their function is diminished, and they have biochemical imbalances along with lots of other problems in the brain. And this nonsense about serotonin being related to depression is on a criminal level of fraud. There are probably, we don't know, maybe 200 neurotransmitters in the brain. In addition, there's a couple hundred million cells in the brain. Many of these cells have as many as 10,000 connections to other cells. To think that one neurotransmitter system has to do with a specific psychiatric problem is foolhardy, especially since we don't even know what the others are doing. And in addition, because of the complexities, we're a million miles away from even knowing how the brain creates a thought or a word. We don't even know what the underlying organizational system of the brain is. So all of this is nothing more than drug company propaganda. But we do know that the drugs don't do what they're supposed to do. The drawing this guy probably did for you is to try to show that the drugs like Prozac and Paxil and Celexa and so on, Zoloft, that they block the removal of serotonin from the active spot in the brain, the synapse it's called, which is the space between one nerve that's stimulating another nerve, and the spark is serotonin. Well, there are, you know, infinite number of neurotransmitters that we haven't even discovered yet, so you know, to say it's serotonin, which in itself we now know has many, many subsets, or for receptors. I mean, it's just all nonsense. But we do know that the brain doesn't like this, that when you try to block the removal of serotonin, basically flooding the engine with serotonin, the brain engine, that several things happen which are very harmful to the brain. First, the cell stops producing serotonin. Second, the cell works even harder to pull the serotonin out against the effect of the Prozac. And third, and most scary to me, the receptors for serotonin experiencing the flooding begin to die back. So all kinds of destructive and toxic processes take place when the Prozac molecule or any one of these other SSRI or related antidepressants, when they cross the blood-brain barrier, you get all these toxic reactions. So one thing we know, and I've written about this extensively in my medical book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, edition two. And to some extent, my popular book, I've written about this stuff too, Medication Madness. What we do know is that the main impact of all psychoactive substances, whether it's alcohol or LSD or Prozac or Abilify or Ritalin, that the main impact is to disrupt the function of the brain. And if, for some reason, the patient or other people, caretakers, incarcerators of the patient, if someone thinks that negative effect is a good effect, then the drug is said to be helpful. A simple example. We know how the stimulant drugs affect children because we can see it in animals. They crush spontaneity. And happy chimps will no longer be happy. They'll no longer zip around. They'll no longer swing. They won't kiss each other and hug each other and indulge in competitive hierarchical engagements and so on. You give the chimp the stimulant drug, amphetamine, which is dexedrine or Adderall, or you give them Ritalin, which is methylphenidate. You give many of these stimulant drugs, and the chimps just reduce all their spontaneous behavior. And then secondly, because of an effect on a part of the brain called the basal ganglia, probably, they get compulsive. So now instead of a free-roaming chimp, you got a chimp sitting in a corner compulsively pulling out his hair or playing with a pebble or chewing on bars. Now, we make children into good caged chimps when we give them these drugs. And it's a matter of degree. It's related to the dose and the kid's sensitivity. So the kid may lose a little bit of spontaneity, and so the parents are relieved and the teachers don't have to pay attention to them anymore, and they get a bit more compulsive. So they'll do some compulsive rule following. And in the extreme, these children are also described as robotic when they get an extreme reaction. So it's a matter of degree. But all the psychiatric drugs work by disabling the brain. And that's the sad thing about what we're doing to our kids. We are disabling the brains of our wonderful young children instead of teaching them discipline and getting them excited about education. It's a tragedy. It's an outrage.
Well, let me go down this road. This is, you know, my story. I had gone to a physician for something, and it was, you know, unrelated to anything psychological. It was just, I went in for a problem of some sort. I don't know if it was bronchitis or something, you know. And all of a sudden, the physician says, well, you know, really and truly, with your personality type, you really need to be on an antidepressant like, I believe at that time, they had given me Celexa. Well, I didn't know anything about this stuff. I had no idea what it was or how it worked or anything about it at all. So I began to take it. And just taking for granted that I must have a need for this, you know. Well, I took it, and after about maybe 2 or 3 weeks, I recall sitting in the living room and hearing a bell ring. I mean, a big bell. And, of course, I've got no bell in the house. And I began to think about it, and I could recall hearing doors slam that I didn't have in the house as well. I mean, I never had any doors of any kind like that. Maybe when I was a kid, there was a door like that somewhere that I'd heard slam, but these doors would slam every once in a while. I'd be sitting there, all of a sudden, I hear a door close. I was like, what is this? You know, I've never, you know, and I hadn't at that point, I didn't relate it at all to the fact that I was taking this drug. And then I was on my way somewhere and I was traveling along the freeway. And I remember this thought coming to me that I wondered how it would feel if I were to drive the automobile straight into the concrete. I wondered what it would feel like, the metal crunching, you know, going in. And then it hit me. I thought to myself, I think it may be this wacky pill they've got me taking. And so I stopped taking it. I just said, that's it. I don't need this. I've never had anything like this in my whole life, you know. And now I'm beginning to think I'm crazy. So I stopped taking it. And then over the next, I guess I want to say maybe month, I'd be awake in the middle of the night like somebody had just zapped my head with an electrical probe. This is zip, you know, this thing would just, you know, shock you. It'd feel like somebody was giving you an electrical shock, wake you up out of a dead sleep. And it was painful on top of that. And this went on for a month, maybe more. You know, and I thought to myself, this is insanity. What in the world is this? Well, I mean, I was lucky. I think I was very lucky because a lot of people would just plod right along and keep taking the meds. And I thought to myself, then I thought, man, there's something really wrong about this. Then another friend of mine went to a physician for something like a sinus infection. And the first thing they tried to do was to put them on an SSRI drug. And I don't remember which one it was, but they were trying to get them to take this thing. And I thought, what is this all about? Nobody went to the physician with any kind of a psychological problem. These were physical ailments unrelated to anything psychological. These are doctors. They're not psychiatrists. They're not psychologists. And yet it's like they're on the edge of their seat wanting to write a script for this stuff. And, you know, I've got other friends of mine that took SSRIs, and I watched their whole personalities change. They got to the point where you couldn't hardly stand to be around them. I mean, they were completely different people. And then when those same people came off of those drugs, for whatever reason, they were back to their old selves again, you know? What about all that? I mean, am I over exaggerating? Am I overreacting? Or the story I'm telling you, does it hold water?
A brief question. How long were you on the Celexa before you came off? Because you had a serious withdrawal reaction. I would expect you'd been on for a few months.
No, actually, I had been on it maybe 3 weeks or 4 weeks, you know, when I began to experience the bell and the doors, you know, and then maybe another month. So I was only on the drug maybe 3 months at the most. You know, and then that was it. I just, you know, I didn't even call the physician. I just threw the stuff in the trash. I said, that's it, you know.
And well, your story actually, Ted, is a classic example of the effects of all of the SSRI drugs, except that after 3 months, I wouldn't usually expect quite so severe a withdrawal reaction, but it's not at all unheard of. In my book, Medication Madness, there are several stories that are very closely parallel what you described, but worse. That's how they got in the book. I became a medical expert for these people. In one case, a very sweet man who, you know, had a little bit of sadness about him, but he's a very kind man, very successful, got a nice small business, very active in his church, very known as a very altruistic man. Happened to be in his doctor's office, again, not for a psychiatric problem, but for, you know, some sort of a physical problem that was eventually proved to be nothing. He saw an, quote, educational material about Paxil, the SSRI. Thought it was legitimate educational material rather than just an ad the doctor allowed in his office. Asked the doc about this, and the doc gave him Paxil. He got so agitated that he wanted to kill himself. Then he became concerned that he'd be leaving his wife behind, so he thought he should kill her. He had so little knowledge of anything but the straight life that he couldn't figure out how to get a gun. So he decided that what he'd do is drive to the police station, and he'd seen police cars with guns standing up inside them, which he thought were rifles. They were shotguns. He didn't know anything about these kind of guns. When I asked him, he had no idea whether you had to cock them or how you'd shoot them. He decided to go down to the police station and get one. Along the way, he sees a cop giving a ticket, and the policeman's sitting in his car, and he expects the policeman's going to get out soon. So he parks, in a space that didn't look suspicious. I was behind the police car, and when the cop got out of the car, he crashed his car into the police officer, knocked him down, broke his leg, jumped on him, started screaming, "I don't want to hurt you, I just want your gun to kill myself." He was subdued by a good Samaritan and the police officer. And when I got through writing my extensive report on how these drugs make people crazy like that, the policeman didn't press charges. And my client ended up not spending much time in jail, which was a legal miracle. But he never recovered from the guilt and shame he felt about hurting the policeman like this. He wasn't, the kind of guy who said, "Wow, I got off on a Twinkie defense, only a Paxil defense." He was just, he remained sad for a long time afterward about what had happened. Another case involving an automobile, which is very common. People commonly feel like driving their cars into something on these drugs. I actually noticed that and wrote about it in 1994 in Talking Back to Prozac. It was so common. Another one of my cases, a man became psychotic on the drug, never been mentally disturbed in his life, thought he saw special writings on benches in the cemetery for him, decided his wife was an alien, then decided he was an alien, that his wife was here to destroy world, he was here to save world. He ended up driving his car into a stanchion in the hope of destroying both of them and his wife, who was the alien invader. And before I entered the case, he got a not guilty by reason of insanity. So that was without me. But they didn't want to blame the drugs. So they loaded him up on the same drugs he'd been on before, which included Zoloft, which was the drug that had driven him crazy. And I got to know him afterward when he was referred to me to come off his medication, and I took him off his meds. He's many years ago now. He's remarried. He's just a really good man, driven crazy by Zoloft. And the reaction you described, the withdrawal reaction, is very common after these drugs. People call it electroshocks in the head, electrical feelings in the head. Some people get them down their bodies. Other people get horrible instability and dizziness. People get fatigue and crashing depression. So, one message for your listeners, Ted, is, hear me talking about how harmful these drugs are, and read my books and see the scientific references I give, but don't just stop taking psychiatric drugs, because most of the time you're going to need a careful withdrawal, hopefully with some sort of supervision. And since psychiatrists don't like to take people off drugs, what I recommend is that you work with a good therapist and your primary care doctor. And then you're more likely to get a sympathetic ear to coming off the drugs and from your psychiatrist. And I say that as a psychiatrist, it's just a shame.
Well, I've had friends of mine say, my friend so-and-so suffers from depression, and he does a whole lot better when he's on the drugs. What is that all about? Because I can't imagine that being the actual case. I mean, to me, it seems like wishful thinking and a combination of other things. But I've heard this. He's been off his drugs for a while, and he's not quite himself. When he gets on, when he goes through depression, and the doctor will step up the antidepressant drug to eliminate an increase in depression, and. I don't know. I mean, but yet those folks will swear that they work. Boy, if he's not on his drugs, you can't stand to be around him. I guess I'm thinking that there's something wrong with the person that needs to be fixed. I mean, that somebody needs to be, either they're deprived of their identity, they're deprived of love, or they don't know how to love. They there's things about them that are wrong, and instead of somebody working with them and trying to bring them out of themselves, so to speak, they just lobotomize them with a drug. I mean, that's just what it seems to me. I mean, am I off here?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I totally agree with you. In fact, most problems that people struggle with, which is a question you asked me earlier, gosh, that we have so much to talk about. We go in one direction, go in another, but I hope it's interesting. And now let's just go for a minute in the direction of what do people really need, which you've talked about a few times very, very succinctly and very well, and then also contrast it with what's happening with these people who the friend says is doing better on the drugs. People need to figure out how to take charge of their lives. Everybody who comes to therapy has an area of their lives that they have lost control over or never had control over. For some people, it's raising their kids. For some people, it's, and very commonly, it's their love relationships. For other people, it's work. And you can usually find out which area it is by asking the person which area of life is it possible for you and other people to take charge of. And one person will say, oh, gosh, work, you know, take charge of work, but nobody can have a good marriage. Then you talk to somebody else and they'll say, well, having a good marriage, that's you know, I really get that. Lots of people do that. But, who, you know, who enjoys work? So people have their own ideas about the areas they can't handle and they can't manage. And those ideas generally come out of self-defeating viewpoints they learned in childhood. They learned that you can't have love and from mom and dad and from brothers and sisters and terrible experiences or sex abuse. Or they've learned that a man can't really get a decent job from their alcoholic father. They have wrong ideas and wrong approaches and disturbed emotions, if it's severe, usually from childhood, and sometimes developed also in adulthood. You send a young man or woman to war, and they're going to come back with a lot of distorted perceptions. We call it PTSD, but it's, you know, it's being shocked and overwhelmed by war. Now, when a person comes to therapy, the most important single thing you can begin with is, let's talk about what it's like to take charge of an area of your life. And then you can get down to the particulars, and you mentioned some of them. A lot of it, it's about loving. Loving work, loving the opposite sex, loving friends, loving children, loving nature. I believe in loving God. Very, very important for most people in America. So it's love, which I define, Ted, as joyful awareness. Being joyfully aware of some aspect of life will get you through. And being depressed or being withdrawn or being psychotic is always, to some degree, a withdrawal of love. It's a withdrawal of your feeling engaged, connected, caring, excited, and happy about life. So that's like a real simple formulation of what I believe. Now, very simple formulation. Now, what happens to the person who his friends say he's doing better than ever on the drugs? There's a couple of things that are happening there. One, they may have seen their friend go through a terrible time before they got on drugs. What they don't know is how that could have become a great adventure for improving life beyond what the person ever imagined. And that's what I tell people. They come to me horribly depressed. I say, as depressed as you are, that's the energy that you could bring to happiness. So you have more capacity to be happy than other people because you have such energy. Now it's suppressed. So I make the crisis into something positive to grow from. When you go and you get a drug, that never, never happens. The drug, at best, makes the crisis less painful without changing anything in the person's life. At best, it's an anesthesia. Now, over time, if the person tries to stop the drug, they go through what you went through. They go through a withdrawal reaction, so then everybody thinks, oh, you need the drug. This happens with children all the time. The teacher hears the kid's just come off the drug and sees his behavior is really agitated and says to the mom, your kid missed his drug, needs to be on it. When in fact, what the teacher's seeing is a withdrawal reaction from the drug. Now, over time, all psychiatric drugs produce and I have a new scientific article out about this, called chronic brain impairment. They produce a reduction in cognitive acuity, your speed of thinking, your accuracy, your your memory, your ability to multitask is one of the first signs people notice. They produce that kind of a problem. They also produce emotional instability, impulsivity, kind of cycling up and down. And they also produce apathy and indifference. And finally, they produce an effect, big word, anosognosia. They produce an effect that you don't know that you're impaired. All drugs, whether you're drinking alcohol and think you can drive when you can't, or you're smoking marijuana and think your jokes are brilliant when they're dumb, all drugs produce an inability to see the deficit that you're experiencing. So the person then is in this chronic impairment, and they may not have this severe suffering acutely anymore, but they're now actually in a chronic state of impairment. And often you can have complete recovery from stopping the drug, but not always. It then somewhat depends on the drug. So the person settles into this state, and they don't recognize it. But often a loved one will. Early on, I saw men coming in on SSRIs saying, oh, I couldn't do without my drug. I'm just not suffering anymore the way I was. And the wife will say, and, honey, you don't seem to care about me or the kids anymore. And when was the last time we even made love or hugged or said I love you? So the person doesn't perceive what's going on. And the average psychiatrist has no idea about what I'm talking about right now. And the average prescriber, the family doc, the pediatrist, they got no idea about what I'm talking about right now.
Well, you know, I guess I'd like to ask this question. When you talk about the person that has become disenfranchised, basically. I got into a discussion with a friend of mine that's a psychologist, and the terminology came up in the conversation in regards to, I guess, finding fulfillment and happiness and all this kind of stuff apart from drugs. And he came up with a term, two terms, actually. He came up with one called the tyranny of appearance, which I really loved. And the other one was daring not to be first. And I think what I'm seeing is that the folks that get on these drugs lose touch with things like empathy. They lose touch with deep emotional feelings. They no longer know the inner parts of their own heart, much less the inner parts of a spouse's heart or a friend's heart or a lover's heart. They don't have the ability to peer in there and see what's there or be able to feel the empathy with another individual. And it seems to me that the ones that are on the drugs become very self-focused. Now, am I off on this one?
It's really interesting, Ted. You and I don't know each other at all, really. We just met. But it sounds like you've been reading my books forever. We are so in agreement on these issues. Empathy is at the heart of a good life. All good religion says that. All good philosophy says that. Our ability to care for one another, to feel into the shoes of another, is at the heart of a good, caring, ethical, responsible life. My wife and I, in fact, the organization we founded is called the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living. The center, people can get to the center through empathictherapy.org. empathictherapy.org. And we hold a, we're going to have our annual meeting April 13th through 15th in Syracuse, New York. empathictherapy.org. You're absolutely right. And the first thing that brain injury that affects the frontal lobes and limbic system, that is the higher centers. You don't necessarily get this from, say, a stroke that just is affecting the operation of your left hand. But when you have a generalized brain injury or an injury to the frontal lobes and limbic system, the highest centers, the first thing to go is empathy. You think about what is the purpose of the frontal lobes. Why do we have these great, big, flowering protuberances that fill up the front of our heads? And we're so different from dogs and even chimps who have flat frontal heads, because they have little tiny frontal lobes. I even tease myself in sheepdogs, you have such little tiny frontal lobes. Well, what is frontal lobe development about? It's not about engineering. because when these things reached their fulfillment over 100,000 years ago, we weren't even living in cities with towns or villages. We were living in tribes out in the wild. We weren't doing calculations of any great nature. We weren't even doing great paintings. It would be even later on before we started doing paintings. So why in the world? We certainly weren't doing cell phones, right? So why in the world, 100,000 years ago, did we develop this whole system that we now have? And we developed it in order to relate to each other. So the main function of these frontal lobes, their origins, their importance, is social. It's psychosocial. It's the ability to care about one another and to be a family and a tribe, which is what distinguishes us in our survival from all the other kinds of creatures. And so when you give any kind of psychoactive substance, because all of them are going to impede overall brain function. Again, whether it's alcohol or marijuana or LSD or Paxil or Prozac, or whether it's a drug you're taking at a rave, or whether it's a head injury, if the head injury is generalized, you're right on. The first thing to go is empathy. And the first thing you want to work on, among the first things you want to work on as a therapist in helping a human being survive, is not me first, me, I'm the greatest, me, I'm important. The first thing you really need to help another human being with is caring about other people. Because that's our salvation, that's our strength, it's what makes us human.
Well, let me ask this question now. In terms of the drugs in general, you know, whether it be Abilify or whether it be Celexa or whatever, do any of these drugs have any medical advantage? Is there anything that those drugs can successfully treat or make better?
No, nothing. There is no drug for a specific medical problem, and there's no drug for a specific emotional problem. And that's why you see people on 5 and 6 drugs over the years as doctors fire shotguns of drugs at them, give them drug salads or cocktails. There is nothing specific. Now, the nearest thing would be alcohol or the benzodiazepines, which in somewhat different ways enhance the suppressive function of a neurotransmitter system called GABA. GABA is the system that puts us into sleep and puts us into somnolence and sedation. And almost all anesthetics, the surgery, are enhancing GABA. And the drugs that we use to suppress anxiety enhance GABA. We enhance the sedative effect. So whether you're drinking alcohol or taking a benzo, excuse me a minute. I just got a little frog in my throat. Whether you're taking alcohol or a benzo, you are suppressing overall brain function, and that will reduce anxiety, because anxiety is one of the higher mental functions. Philosophers have written, you know, peons to anxiety as an existential experience. Well, it is one of the higher human functions, anxiety. And it will get suppressed as you suppress overall brain function and eventually put somebody to sleep or into a coma with these drugs. But that's nothing specific, because you can't do it without suppressing overall brain function. And furthermore, if you look at the studies, for example, for the approval of Xanax or Alprazolam, Xanax, after 8 weeks, the patients were worse, not better. They had more panic than before, and that's because the brain fights back, and patients were actually having more and worse panic after 8 weeks than they were originally because of the brain fighting the Xanax. And yet at the same time, they were becoming addicted, and a significant percentage, even after 6 weeks, could never come off the Xanax. So you're never doing anything specific for a specific medical disorder when you give a psychoactive substance or for a specific even emotional problem. You're always in one way or another depressing brain function, and the effect of the drug is judged to the degree you want that suppression. Whether you want the kid to sit down and shut up in class, to be unspontaneous, that's what you want. And then you can accomplish that with many different drugs, including the stimulants. But you could also accomplish it with Abilify. Or if you want to give the illusion that you're not feeling so much anxiety, you could take alcohol or one of the anti-anxiety drugs, but it's going to suppress overall function and come back to bite you. If you want a person not to care anymore about their hallucinations or delusions, to just not even bother to tell you about them anymore because they don't care about them, give them Abilify or Zyprex or Risperdal, but you'll notice they also don't care anymore about who wins the baseball championship, the World Series, even though they cared a lot about it last year, and they won't care about their wives and children or husbands as much anymore either.
Well, the reason why I was asking this, though, is because, you know, I've come across some things on the internet that were written, as well as some folks that I know, and one particular person who was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and they were prescribed Celexa because they said Celexa would ease the pain and would help with the fibromyalgia. And I read also on the internet, where I was reading, of course, the internet's a real good place to get medical advice. it's a hypochondriac's heaven, you know, that in reality, that the story that Celexa or other SSRIs were effective in the treatment of fibromyalgia was an invention of the drug companies just to sell more drugs. So I read both of those, and in talking with one friend that has fibromyalgia, says that the Celexa actually did ease the pain and some of the things, but they also felt that it was hurting their memory, you know, and other things. And of course, that individual went cold turkey and came off the Celexa, and then, boy, it was like all hell broke loose. What about that? Is there any benefits of taking an SSRI to treat something like fibromyalgia? Does it help at all?
Well, whatever degree it helps, in my opinion, far outweighed by the hazards we've been talking about. And then you have to ask, well, how might it seem to help? Well, antidepressants have been used for decades, even before the newer ones, for pain relief. So it's possible, although I don't know, it's been proven that there may be some specific pain relieving quality, physical pain relieving quality to these drugs. I think it's doubtful. I'm not sure there's any good research to indicate that it does. So what is happening? The drugs can do one of two things. Sometimes in a mixture, they can produce an artificial euphoria. All the antidepressants can cause euphoria and eventually mania, far more commonly with the new antidepressants than most doctors realize. So you can get an artificial euphoria for a time and you feel better. That's very rarely does that last more than a few days or weeks. Or you get the apathy that I've been talking about, which is the common effect, especially long-term, of all these antidepressants. They cause apathy and indifference. So the person may care less about their pain. They care less about their aches and pains, but they're caring less about everything. And over time, this apathy will grow. And indeed, even some of the textbooks, like the American Textbook of Psychiatry, now acknowledge what we've known for years, which is that you can get an apathy syndrome that's so severe, even psychiatrists are noticing it now, claiming it's temporary, it'll go away if you stop the drug, but not necessarily. I mean, effects that we create over years and years don't necessarily go away. So what you're going to get is apathy over time. Now, other problems are that it will easily end up worsening the experience of the fibromyalgia, because one of the things you get from these drugs is exhaustion and achy muscles. through the cardinal symptoms of fibromyalgia, tiredness, exhaustion, and achy muscles. And on withdrawal, you can get it very severely in a somewhat lasting fashion. So I would not give these drugs for fibromyalgia.
Let me ask this question. If for those folks that may be listening that are on an SSRI, and let's just take Celexa as an example. If you've taken this drug, say, for years, and all of a sudden you just stop, what is going to be the scenario?
If you try abruptly to stop an SSRI after several months or years, you run into, I would say, one of the worst possibilities, crashing depression and suicidal behavior. You can also get the opposite, and it's hard to predict. You can get euphoric or manic. In my practice, I specialize in withdrawing people from these medications. And by the way, Ted, I have a chapter in each of my newest books on how to withdraw from the drugs, both medication madness and brain disabling treatments in psychiatry. Second edition have chapters on this. You can get to those books and to me, you have, by the way, at Breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com. So you can go into an elevated mood. You more likely can go into a crashing depression. You can get terrible shocks in the head and electrical feelings. These can go down your arms and legs and be extremely distressing. Very commonly, you can go into a state of imbalance that's hard to describe. Usually, the person will say, well, I don't know what's going on. I just want to sit still. I turn my head. I feel weird, like I'm dizzy. And then you ask, is the room spinning? No, it's not like the room's spinning. It's like you're going to faint. No, it's not like I'm going to faint. It's like I'm just not right in space. Or I just feel like I'm not moving right, or I'm going to fall over. And I have to sit very still and not move my head or neck. People can get all kinds of gastrointestinal upsets coming off these drugs. What I tell my patients is expect anything out of the ordinary emotionally that's happening to you, anxiety, depression, euphoria, mania, terrible neurological sensations anywhere in your body, sounds that you didn't expect to hear, and hyperacusis, hyper-responsiveness to sound. Almost anything can come over you. And one of the most dangerous things that happens is people get agitated and sometimes violent. I have seen the sweetest, most educated, lovely, not that you have to be educated to be sweet and lovely, but really, really successful human beings become a menace to their families when withdrawing from these drugs, the struggling with violence. And then, of course, in medication madness, I tell story after story of people who actually, men and women and children, who actually kill themselves or someone else while coming off these drugs. So it's a serious matter, and I'm glad you're emphasizing it with me.
Well, one of the common things that I hear so much about, and that is sleep disorders. You know, people lay awake all night long. They say they can't turn their brain off. And I guess in one case, one particular individual is saying something to the effect that that some of the SSRI drugs actually help them sleep. From your standpoint, what causes this lay awake all night, the brain running 100 miles an hour, and what is it that you see as a psychiatrist? Is the way to attack that problem other than, say, through, drugs of some sort?
Well, you're certainly right that it's a very, very common problem. And there's many different approaches to the problem and many good books out there on relaxation techniques and sleeping. I mean, just go to any bookstore or go online and you'll find a lot to embellish on what I'm about to tell you. But there's a number of important approaches to sleep problems. First of all, you want to find out from the person, are they having trouble falling asleep? Are they having trouble waking up in the middle of the night? And you want to find out from the person what's the content that they're staying awake with. One person may be swirling around, as you've mentioned, with ideas. Another person might be obsessing over not getting the proper last word in and during the day, and over issues where they have felt disrespected and put down. Another person may be feeling guilty and obsessing over guilt. Another person may be very anxious about the future. So you want to find out what it is that they are struggling with. And another thing that you want to find out is, how do they handle the 4 or 5 hours before sleep? If they're drinking, that's very likely one of the contributions. If they're using psychoactive substances, including antidepressants, some of which, well, really, the newer antidepressants can either cause insomnia or somnolence or both. I mean, they're not sleeping meds. They actually cause insomnia, but they also cause somnolence in some people. And you've quite significant percentages of people will become either somnolent or insomniac on the drugs. So once you've looked at all this, one of the simpler things to do is to talk about, what are your rituals for going to bed? And what were they when you were really doing well? Because it may be that in recent times, for some reason, the person's given up their ritual of reading for an hour in bed, or watching a TV. Well, what do you watch? Oh, I watch CSI. Well, I'd have trouble going to sleep right after that. Why don't you try watching The Waltons or Hallmark? But seriously, you have to find ways that bring you peace before bed. Listening to music, having a snack, taking a bath. Many things that we have to teach our children to do before bedtime. Enjoying your loved one if you have someone that you're with. So the rituals that you develop before bed are incredibly important. Then, if you're in therapy or if you're trying to help yourself, you want to know what's the content of what's making it hard for you to sleep. And then you can address that content. Maybe you can write down the things that are worrying you or making you anxious or making you feel humiliated. Write them down before you go to sleep. Put them in a box and say, stay there till the morning. Something that encourages you to take these issues and put them aside. Or if they wake you up at night, get up, make a list of the things that are worrying you and say, I will deal with you in broad daylight. And some people who have trouble sleeping, especially if it's lifelong, goes back to abuse in childhood. So you see how complicated it is. It's very common, if you've been sexually abused in childhood, for going to bed to feel very dangerous and risky and vulnerable, because that's when you were most vulnerable to the abusive parent sneaking into your room to abuse you. So it's an issue that's a human issue, and I'm glad we're looking at it, because it shows, just at my brief description, it shows you the complexity of something seemingly as simple.
Let me ask you this question, and not to oversimplify, because I think that in the time that we have to talk, it's going to have to be oversimplified to some degree. But if a person has suffered, you know, childhood abuse, and this is what's keeping them awake, what is a plan of attack? As a psychiatrist, what would you recommend for a person to do to help combat that history, you know, revisiting you? And I'm thinking that a person may not even know that that's what's revisiting them. But what would you, how would you lead them in what direction?
Well, first, all of the things that I described would go into helping anyone who's having a sleep problem. If the person's abused, they probably have a lot more problems than just sleep, and you're probably dealing with a lot of anxiety or a lot of cycling of feeling, you know, pressed inexplicably out of the blue, and you can really often find that it's worst when the person's in contact with mother or father, if they're alive, or someone else in the family, because often the abuse is in the family. You can get some hints that it's coming from that direction, or they may have some memories, or they may have nightmares of abuse. And then you're dealing with a caring, hopefully informed therapy, where you first establish that the adult can handle what happened in childhood. So you don't want to go back ever into your childhood if you're feeling overwhelmed by it. So first you want to establish that the adult can handle these things and remain an adult while going back and having empathy for the child. That wonderful thing that you brought up earlier that's central to my thinking and my work and our organization. Empathy. You want to go back with empathy for the child because, in fact, children blame themselves. They can't blame their parents. That just obliterates all hope. So they blame themselves and they try to be better and better and better and better. The people who come for therapy, they're the ones who want to be better and better and better. The people who have abuse and then go on and abuse others don't come for therapy usually, unless they're forced to by the courts or they're in jail or something. So we're mostly dealing in therapy with people who have handled abuse by deciding they were never going to be bad. They were never going to do that to people. They were going to be good people. So they're going to blame themselves. So you go back and you help folks relive and remember. I do it without fancy techniques because I want people to do it under their own steam. So we go back and we talk about the past and we look at times in the past, look for landmarks, and look for times when abuse might have occurred. And often it will surface, and I'm sure there's a lot of abuse that never is recognized. Rarely is any faked. That's only done when adults are manipulating the therapy. In my experience, you know, for some political or legal reason, they'll get somebody to remember something that never happened. But if you're in an unbiased fashion trying to figure out if there was abuse, people don't generally fake it or make it up. They generally don't want to remember. The opposite. So in a good therapy, you're looking back and you're going back with empathy for the child. And then you look at it and you say, now, you know, what did you learn from this? Well, I learned to, you couldn't trust anybody. Well, of course you learned that, but maybe you could change that as an adult. Or, you know, I learned all men want is sex, period. They don't care about you as a person. Well, that certainly was true in your childhood with your disgraceful father and big brother, but it may not be so with all the men you meet. So let's reconsider that. So as with any therapy, you relearn better, more useful approaches in adult life. I rarely talk this much about therapy. It's wonderful that we have the time to do it, but that's a general approach. It makes sense to you, Ted?
No, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. You know, I think things that are traumatic in childhood have a way of hiding when we get to be adults. And I had a memory come to me here some time ago that I had a relative that my mom and dad would drop me off at this person's house. And they would watch me while they went and did something, you know, like, oh, I don't know, maybe they went to dinner or a movie or something. And this abusive person had a bedroom in the basement. And they would take me downstairs. There was a bed down there, and they would put me in that room. And the light switch was on the outside of the room, but they'd put me in that room, turn out the light, lock the door. And their parting statement was, I hope when I come for you in the morning, you'll be in here. And I was terrorized over that. I mean, I was absolutely, totally terrorized. I'd never had anything like that happen. And what was strange is I don't understand the mechanics behind the fact that my grandmother evidently knew about it because she told my mom, she said, I would never take that child over there after what they did to him, you know. But I know that it... I remembered that at like age, you know, in my late 50s, all of a sudden this memory pops up and I remembered that. And I thought, well, you know, that might explain a little bit as to why I'm phobic about certain things, you know. But those memories can hide. You know, they can just lurk in the darkness, you know, and push your buttons today, you know, and you can't figure out why it is that your buttons are being pushed. And of course, then, instead of resolving the problem, we're trying to deal with it. The answer is, well, let's just write a prescription. And that way, you don't care. You know? And then you sign out. All parts of you, every part of your brain signs out, evidently. You know, and once again, you sacrifice the empathy that makes you human. And you become something that really and truly is far less than human. And I see this, and it's really troubling. And I really admire your guts to come forward and talk about this. The only thing that I wonder about is, have you not been shot at for this?
Well, let me address first what you said, because you're just perfectly describing what happens with people who have been traumatized. And people who have had very deprived childhoods where there wasn't love, where there weren't markers of happy holidays or happy occurrences, may have very little memory for the first 10 years of their lives. They may literally have almost no contact with what went on those 10 years. Or they may be totally obliterated for the first 5, where many people will have, you know, some memories for the first 5 years. So, yeah, it does. It just gets pushed out of the way. Now, in terms of what has been done to me, yes, starting with 1970s, when I was a young psychiatrist and I decided it was my task to stop lobotomy from coming back, I have had every possible attack and threat made. If you can imagine it, Ted, and those of you listening, it probably happened to me. Whether we're talking about a murder attempt, or we're talking about threats, or we're talking about national organizations attacking me, whatever it is, you imagine it, and it's probably been a part of my experience over the years. But I'm very proud to say that because I weathered that, there are now a handful of other psychiatrists standing up on these issues, not as fully and powerfully as I am, but there are a handful of psychiatrists standing up on these issues, and many other help, many psychologists and social workers and counselors and so on now, and addiction specialists are standing up on these issues. But I took the brunt of being the first person in psychiatry to stand up and declare the emperor had no clothes.
I've always loved that story. The emperor's new clothes. I don't know. And you see it in life all the time, you know, where the guy doesn't have any clothes on, and no one in the crowd has guts enough to say, hey, something's wrong with this picture.
You see, the emperor has a royal guard that will shoot down the first person that says it, unlike in the story. In reality, the emperor has weapons, if no clothes.
Yeah, I just cannot get over how trigger happy physicians are to write these prescriptions. It's absolutely incredible, and they write them in conditions like I described, when they're totally inappropriate. You go in for a sinus infection, they want to put you on an SSRI. It doesn't make any sense. You know, I guess it makes sense from the standpoint if you're following a dollar bill. I guess if you follow the dollar bill, it makes perfect sense. Because for writing all those scripts, they get certain perks. I don't know what they are, and I don't know how it all works. But I know every time I go into a doctor's office, there's at least 3 or 4 people coming in there with carts.
Yeah.
You know, well-dressed, they sign in, they disappear into the back, they have precedence over all the patients, and it's aggravating, you know, it really is. And I was sitting in a waiting room one time, and I've never been known to be, I guess I want to say, at a lack of words or being able to express myself. And one came in, I said, well, you know, you drug salesman, I said, you come in here, you take cuts. I said, what are you peddling today, cancer? And he gave me a blank look. I wasn't his favorite person that day. But it's really what I felt.
Yeah.
But now, okay.
You know, Ted, I think a lot of the regular docs are well-motivated. You know, it makes them some money in that by giving meds, they can have short visits and charge them to insurance companies and so on. But I think the primary care docs, they really think they're doing the right thing, and they just don't know the facts. You know, for example, they have no idea that Prozac was only tested for 4 to 6 weeks, and that the reason why many of the studies only went 4 weeks was because the patients were dropping out like flies from adverse effects. They don't know that the Prozac, the manufacturer, Eli Lilly, cheated by giving tranquilizers to calm down the patients who were agitated by Prozac, that they did this against the rules, and that when the drug couldn't be approved without patients who are also being drugged with tranquilizers. The FDA allowed it. They don't know that the Eli Lilly hid the fact that they knew in the 80s, before the drug was approved, that they had an increased suicide attempt rate in these small clinical trials. So, you know, they don't know that Eli Lilly knew before the drug was approved that their claim about increasing the activity of serotonin was fake because the brain was reacting against it and shutting down serotonin to protect the brain. So the average, all of which is in my books, obviously, but the average doc has no idea about any of what I just said.
I just read an article somewhere where they were talking about the fact that they had now determined that serotonin in itself, if it occurs excessively in the brain, is actually worse than a shortage of serotonin. And it can produce all sorts of effects. And they were talking about the fact that the link between serotonin levels and depression, everything that we have that's been written so far has been basically published without any criteria.
It's just drug company propaganda.
And I read that and I thought, wow, this is totally the opposite of anything and everything I've read and studied so far. Now, you've written, you've got a new book out. Tell us a little bit about that and talk a little bit about the organization you formed, because I can't help but believe that in the midst of all of this, that you're also a provider of alternate solutions, and we need to hear about those.
Well, first of all, my name, it's for folks, because it's an unusual name, is Peter Breggin, B-R-E-G-G-I-N. And you can find out a ton of information, not just about me, mostly about the subjects, on my website, breggin.com. There's also a professional Facebook that my wife has done and conducts, and sometimes I come on it and comment, Peter Breggin, Dr. Peter Breggin Facebook. Our organization is the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, or empathictherapy.org, empathictherapy.com. Empathic therapy, anything will get you there. And that consists of two very different viewpoints that are interrelated, and you've heard them on the show. The one is that there are best ways to help people, and they always involve empathy and caring. They always involve high ethics and principles and ideals. They always involve treating human beings as choice-making people rather than machines, treating human beings as agents, as actors, as beings, as something far more than mechanical boxes to be banged and readjusted. So that's the positive part. We even have guidelines for empathic therapy that I wrote with the help of some of my advisory council members. We've got more than 50 great advisory council members from neurology, psychiatry, medicine, psychology, social work, the ministry, just from education across the board. That's one part of what we do. The other part is a new page that is a part of empathic therapy, which is called Toxic Psychiatry, named after one of my early books, toxicpsychiatry.org or .com. And Toxic Psychiatry has just tons of scientific articles bolstering the views I'm talking about today, including a whole bunch of articles about how these psychiatric drugs are making people worse and causing brain damage. So you can go to toxicpsychiatry.org, Breggin.com, empathic therapy. You get all this wonderful information. My latest two books are Medication Madness. The subtitle is The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime. I do a great deal of legal work. Recently, for the first time in North America, based on my testimony, a Canadian judge found that a 16-year-old had stabbed his friend to death because of Prozac. And believe me, it was really obvious. I was able to really just draw this whole long picture. And the judge listened to my testimony at length. He listened to the opposing psychiatric testimony from Canada and concluded that I was correct. And so this young man isn't going to have to spend the rest of his life in jail because the judge recognized that Prozac pushed him over. And indeed, the Canadian equivalent of the FDA warns that all these drugs, the SSRIs, can cause harm to self and others. They're even more direct than the FDA. They can cause harm to others. It warns about it. So there are lots of stories about this. It reads like a science fiction and legal fiction, but it's all fact. 50 cases that are totally factual, with only the masquerading of the identities of some of the people, but not all of them. These are cases where I went to the crime scene in some of them, and in all of them I saw the medical records and educational records and, you know, interviewed sometimes a dozen survivors, and the person was still alive. So it's a wonderfully interesting book. It has a lot of science in it. And then the other, that is a scientific, wholly scientific book, also the latest, is Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition. If you read those two books, you're going to know more than your psychiatrist about psychiatric drugs and electroshock. I guarantee you'll know more than your psychiatrist does.
Well, you know, something we didn't talk about was electroshock therapy. And I remember when I was a kid, I remember hearing a lot about that. That was a big thing, electroshock therapy. And, you know, I wondered at that point, I thought, well, how is it that they would know what part of the brain to electrocute in order to get the effect that they want? Or how do you do that without electrifying the entire brain? You know, and you know, it seems to me, at least as a kid, I thought, I don't think they really know all about that. I don't think they really understand how the brain even operates, you know, why in the world. I mean, you know, I've heard the story that if a person, if they're, let's say, on an operating table or whatever, and part of the skull is open or whatever, that an electrical probe with just a very low, very extremely low voltage is applied to the brain, that you will immediately get the effect of reliving certain moments in your past, almost like as if someone's playing a movie reel or playing back a video. These individual memories and things, in other words, as they touch different parts of the brain, it just all comes to life as if somebody pushed a playback button on a VCR. It just seems so complex of something to be messing around with without having any more knowledge of it than what we do. And I just don't think we know that much.
Well, once again, my new friend said, you're right on. I mean, you're right on. Electroshock comes out of the late 1930s, along with insulin coma shock that I mentioned earlier, where you poison the person by giving them insulin so they don't get any sugar in the brain and they go to a coma, and lobotomy. And electroshock is a closed-head lobotomy, because at least one of the electrodes is always over the frontal lobe. So you're always getting a searing shock through the frontal lobes. In addition, because the head acts like a resistor and the electricity builds up all around the skull, you get breakthroughs of the electricity throughout the brain. So it's a total brain assault that results in a very damaged, catastrophic reaction in the form of a severe grand mal seizure. Not an ordinary grand mal seizure where a person falls down and falls, but a grand mal seizure so severe that patients used to break their spinal column and their limbs during these seizures, so that the reason now that they put the person under anesthesia, that is, knock them out, and then paralyze their muscles before doing the shock, is simply because they want to stop the bones from breaking. And it works by producing head trauma. So for a few weeks after the shock treatment, you have closed head injury, head trauma, very, very similar to severe head trauma that soldiers get when, you know, bombs blow up underneath their trucks. So it's a real serious head injury. The person loses memory, is delirious, disoriented after several shock treatments. during that period of time, the unconscionable hundreds of psychiatrists that do this procedure will write down in the record, patient complaining less, or patient euphoric, patient having euphoria. No, they don't say that. They say patient's mood elevated. Now, remember, I told you earlier that drugs, and it's true of all damage, really produces one of two reactions, either a brief euphoria or just plain apathy, which can last forever. So the euphoria often comes first, and these unconscionable doctors say, see the improvement? But that's the euphoria brain damage. Or the patient gets apathetic more commonly, and the apathy lasts, and that, the psychiatrist says, complaining less. It's that gross, that bad, that tragic. And I know many fine people, surgeons, some psychiatrists, who subjected to this treatment, nurses, could no longer practice. Lost their educations, lost their abilities. It's a horrific, abusive treatment. We have scientific studies that you can find on toxicpsychiatry.org or .com. You can find on Toxic Psychiatry about the damage inflicted by these drugs. You can find a whole chapter on it in my new book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. It's barbaric. And the fact that I am the first psychiatrist to stand up publicly on lobotomy and the first psychiatrist in history to stand up publicly on electroshock tells you how corrupting all of this is to the people who are in the profession.
Well, you know, I recall seeing as a kid, I don't know where I saw this, but it was almost like a documentary where they showed this fella coming into work in the office, and he was very, very disruptive, had an inappropriate sense of humor, a get-on-your-nerves kind of person. And they showed this guy coming in, interacting with a bunch of people and sitting down at his desk and all this sort of thing. And then they flash to this thing. He's in the doctor's office, and then the next thing, he's in a hospital, and they're giving him electroshock therapy. And they show this thing. And then they show him returning to work as a very calm, sedate individual. He goes in and says, "Hello, Joe. Hello, George." And goes to the water cooler and gets a glass of water, and then calmly goes to his desk and sits down and looks like, you know, the model citizen. And that was what was being portrayed, because I remember that as a kid seeing that. I don't know what it was. I don't know where I saw it. I just remember it. But it was obviously selling electroshock therapy is what it was doing. And I remember watching it thinking to myself, what a crock. You know, I guess it's because I've always been around, you know, electronics and amateur radio and things like that. And I've got a few shocks myself. I mean, I know what electricity feels like. You know, and I thought to myself, this is something about this is just not right. And so now I guess what I was watching there is the equivalent to the television commercials, because it seems like they have a different drug for every imaginable fear. I mean, it's like, well, do you have a fear of elevators? You know, you need whatever this stuff is. And by the way, and then they list this whole list of horrible things that it could possibly do to you, like as if you want to really take that thing. But they always show these people that are, you know, they're walking hand in hand next to a babbling brook out in the country, and they're smiling, and the butterflies and the birds are singing and all this kind of stuff. And all this happens, of course, when you take this drug. And so I guess that things have really not changed very much.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And it hasn't changed with shock treatment. They claim it's new. You know, we got this new thing or new that. But I actually gave the new form of shock treatment in 1962 as a Harvard resident. In my Harvard training program, they told me I'd be fired if I didn't give shock. And one of the shames of my life is, rather than get fired, I gave shock treatment. But I've tried to make up for that. You're watching somebody, to the extent that that was a real portrayal, you're seeing somebody who had a personality and some emotional issues that were making him really difficult to deal with, who then got his brain damaged, so he was now more apathetic and robotic. That's exactly what you were watching.
It seems like there's cycles, though, because I remember when I was younger, the drugs of popularity then were Valium and Librium, and it seemed like everybody was on these things. I remember relatives that took something they called the little purple pill, you know, to settle their nerves, you know. And it seemed like we went through those. You don't hear about Valium and Librium very much anymore. You don't hear anybody talking about them. Now it's all the new designer drugs. But I remember also we went through a period of time where they talked about mood elevators. And I recall I recall a doctor gave me a prescription for something called Elevil. Is that correct?
Yes, Elevil is amitriptyline. It's an older antidepressant.
I never really wound up taking it. I may have taken one or two. I couldn't see that did anything, so I didn't take any more. But that was, you know, that was touted as being, you know, boy, you really need this. This is called Elevil. And I said, well, what is it? It's a mood elevator. And I thought, well, what in the world does that mean? So that's another old, you know, it's history now, evidently.
Well, it's still around. What you're actually describing, Ted, are advertising promotional cycles. When Valium came out, it was a proprietary drug. It was owned by Roche, and they went ahead and they just advertised it with almost the success that Lilly would later advertise Prozac, and again, mostly women taking it. These are advertising cycles. And what wasn't recognized then, but should have been known, was that these drugs were producing drug addicts because they're very addictive drugs. So you're really looking at advertising cycles, promotional cycles. And Eli Lilly just broke the bank in regard to promoting Prozac until it was producing 50% of its or more of its revenues for a while.
How much income is there from these psychiatric drugs? Who's making the money besides the pharmaceutical companies? Is there anyone else?
The pharmaceutical companies are making billions, multiple billions. In fact, the so-called antipsychotic drugs, if they were used as antipsychotic drugs, it's estimated that 1% of the population at most is psychotic, right? And yet, those are the biggest income drugs in the world now, biggest revenue drugs. Not that the most people are taking them. They rank maybe, I don't know, 12th or 15th that way. But they're number one because they're so expensive for revenue. And it's in the billions. And that's Seroquel and Abilify at the top, I think. Figures could be a little off. Now, who gets the money? Everybody in the system gets the money. The FDA, 50%, I've now learned, of the FDA's operating funds to evaluate drugs comes from the drug companies. The FDA is being funded by the drug companies under new laws. So that's one place the money is going. Then they managed to funnel money to NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health Researchers. My wife and I blew the whistle on that years ago. They find ways to get the money to the researchers. Or the researchers go to work for the drug companies after they leave NIMH. Then the money goes into the psychiatric organizations and the medical organizations. The one I know best is the American Psychiatric Association. Drug company funds the journals, funds special fellowships for people at the Psychiatric Association, funds special activities, quote, educational activities that are really drug promotion activities. The drug companies fund conferences. They pay for all kinds of speakers at the conferences, meals at the conference, breakfasts, symphony orchestras at the conference. They give away free stuff at the conferences. To a relatively minor, by comparison, well, no, they fund all the research that goes on. They fund the researchers. They build buildings on university campuses, drug company buildings, fund professorships named after drug companies. The individual practicing doctors, unless they're consultants or doing speeches for the drug companies, get relatively little. They get free lunches. They get an easy way to treat patients and make money that way. But they're not making money hand over fist from this system. But the money just floods everywhere.
Well, how do the insurance companies react to all of this? Because if a person has, you know, prescription drug coverage, how does that work? I mean, I would think the insurance companies would get fed up with this.
The insurance companies believe that it is far, far cheaper to give patients a 10-minute med check once every 1 to 3 months than to pay for psychotherapy on a weekly basis. And that makes some sense. It probably is cheaper for them to have each patient coming once every 1 month or several months for only 15 minutes. But they're overlooking some other factors. First, that these docs are seeing 5 patients an hour, so it might be cheaper on a patient basis, but since their med checks are seeing 4, 5, maybe 6 cramming in patients an hour, they're costing the drug companies a lot more. That's the first thing. And the second thing they're not seeing is research that shows, for example, that up to a third of admissions to psychiatric hospitals are for psychosis caused by antidepressant drugs. So they're not seeing all the money they're pouring out in cost hospitalizations. And I think also there's another phenomena, the top-down phenomena, which is that the drug companies manage somehow or other to get money into the top of big organizations and get these organizations to favor the drugs. I don't know exactly how they do it, who they buy, or how they buy them. There have been books about some of the ways it's done. But, for example, in the military, we are sending soldiers into combat, 20-year-old, 19-year-old youngsters into combat with 180-day, not prescriptions, 180-day supply of addictive stimulant drugs, addictive tranquilizing benzos and antipsychotic drugs. Now, who would do anything that crazy? It's coming from the top down of the military. So, and I think they get to the drug companies in a similar fashion, paying off people. I can't prove that, but it seems like they find a way to get organizations, foster care, whatever the organization is, the drug companies manage to get them to mandate drugs in preference to other treatments.
Well, we're getting close to the end of this here. We kind of want to keep you know, forever. But one thing that I did want to touch on, and that is, you know, everyone I think is familiar with the fact that I guess one of the fellows that one of the clock tower shooters, later it came out that this man was on a psychiatric drug. The kids at Columbine, we had heard that they were also on psychiatric drugs of some sort. And then you just recently went to court and on behalf, and I don't know that whole story. Why don't you relate that story in regards to there was a murder that took place, and I guess you were an expert witness in this.
Yeah, let me talk about Columbine first, because I was a medical expert in 2 or 3 cases surrounding Eric Harris. And one of the things that I found out was that unequivocally Eric Harris was taking Zoloft at the time of the shooting. And I know it unequivocally because I came across an FDA notice sent in under the requirements of drug company reporting that described a mass murder that where the person involved had a, quote, this is so ironic, had a, quote, therapeutic level of Zoloft in his system. I then got the tracking number, ordered the exact case from the FDA, and it was the case of Eric Harris. And I got the coroner's report eventually, and was able to establish without a doubt that he had taken Zoloft shortly before the shootings, or probably the morning of the shootings, from the blood level. Now, despite that, USA Today, as short as recently as a year ago, did a look back in which it asserted that we now know that Eric Harris wasn't taking Zoloft at the time of the shooting. So I wrote them a letter to the editor, gave them the exact identification number of the FDA report and described the autopsy report and offered to mail them copies, and they didn't print a retraction. That's the power of the drug companies top down. That's the power of the drug companies. And tracking Eric Harris's medical records, which I had, he was not a crazy, violent person when they put him on drugs. He was put on drugs for obsessive tendencies. He wasn't writing crazy stuff on his website before they put him on antidepressants. So that's one case. And the case in Canada, but now we span a whole bunch of years, in Canada, a young 16-year-old with the most minor provocation was sitting around pleasantly having a conversation with two of his best friends and picked up a knife and stabbed one of them to death with a single blow. And afterwards said, what else could I do? He had no explanation. When he was imprisoned, I was able to interview him in prison on the phone and then in first person later. But when I interviewed him initially, I was also able to interview his counselor, who said, confirmed what the youngster told me, which is that he'd taken himself off Prozac. He'd asked the nurses in the jail take him off Prozac, and he did. And his personality became that, the counselor said, of an entirely normal person. And in the counselor's 20 or 25 years, he'd never seen such a normal person in this criminal facility. And he was willing to testify to that or to allow me to quote in my report to that effect. I then tracked the young man's story, and he was feeling somewhat depressed, so his parents didn't notice it, but he told them he was and asked to go to the doc. The primary care doc gave him Prozac, and 7 days later, he attempted suicide for the first time in his life. Now, the Canadian warnings say that this drug is not authorized for children. They specifically say that. And they also specifically say that this drug can cause people to become a danger to themselves and others. So the themselves thing happened in 7 days. And it's frequently the case that these terrible things happen within days or weeks of a dose change, either starting the dose, raising the dose, lowering the dose. That's in the FDA descriptions talk about dose changes. Well, I'd been talking about it for years. I think they probably got it from my work. So the primary care guy got concerned. So what does he do? He's a good guy. He refers the young boy and his family, 16-year-old, to the psychiatric clinic in Manitoba, Canada. Well, best thing he could do. And he sends a note with a question mark attached to the Prozac prescription, you know, saying Prozac question mark, wondering about this. The mother tells the people at the clinic that she thinks the Prozac's making her son worse. He's never been suicidal before. They refuse to listen to her. So about 30 days later now, it's been the summertime, he's not in school, the boy has started cutting himself for the first time, having violent fantasies he's telling people about for the first time, running away for the first time, behaving very emotionally unstable for the first time. All the things described in the American and Canadian warnings as overstimulation or activation, just exactly what's being described in the warnings from the federal monitoring agencies in the U.S. and Canada. So the mother finally, after much effort, gets an appointment with another psychiatrist at the clinic. The boy says he thinks the drug's helping him. See, that's what I call medication spellbinding. I describe that in my new book, including medication madness.
So the people taking the drugs are convinced that these drugs are helping.
Very often. And it's true also for marijuana, alcohol, and cocaine. I remember, as a brief aside, giving a talk at a law school about drugs in general, and this guy came up to me afterward and said, he's very hostile, you have no idea. He said, I couldn't have gotten through law school without cocaine. So personal testimonials don't necessarily tell the story. So the boy gets his dose raised and goes home. And another week later or so, he stabs his friend to death. I was brought in, and the judge, it was a the judge's job is first to decide whether to try this young person as an adult or a child. And the state wants to try him as an adult because then he can go to jail for most of his life. But the defense wants him to be tried as a child. So that's the first decision the judge has to make. And the second decision, of course, if he's tried as a child, he's then let out by the time he's an adult, 20 or 21. So he'd only be in jail for a short time. And the second thing the judge has to decide after that is what is this actual sentence. So at this hearing, it was only two people testifying. The guy who actually formed the clinic, founded the clinic at which this occurred, very well-known, respected local psychiatrist, and me. And the judge, in a very lengthy opinion, first starts out describing in detail the local psychiatrist's opinion in Manitoba, Canada. And then he goes and he describes my opinion in equal detail and says that I believe the facts conform to Dr. Bregan's description, that Prozac caused this boy to be violent, that if his Prozac had been stopped instead of increased, this never would have happened. So he said, I'm going to sentence him as a youth. And then shortly later, he had the sentencing hearing and he gave him, I can't remember exactly, but it was less than two more years. And he followed my advice again that the boy be in a supervised setting rather than home, from which he could freely move about and go to work and do other things, but he should come home to a supervised residential setting. And this is the first time that a judge has ever done anything like that in North America, and I think it's happened once in Australia. We've had judges say to juries, you can entertain a Prozac kind of defense, and juries have come back in our favor, but we've never had the judge himself making the determination that Prozac did it. So it was a big deal, and it's really just increasing confirmation of opinions, which I've been, of course, horribly criticized over the years, which now are becoming embodied in the official labels from the FDA, Health Canada, Great Britain, and which are now being confirmed in the court. So it's been a long trip.
Well, sir, we are out of time. I want you again to give out website information and information on books and anything else that you have where folks can contact you and get involved with the work that you're doing. And I'd like for you to do that. And I'd like to, folks, go grab yourself a pen and paper or whatever you need to get and jot this information down. And, of course, I'm going to have links on our website, so you can go to radiodisclosure.com and pick these up, too. But it's just simply Bregin.com, Bregin. Is that not correct?
Yep, that's it, Bregin.com. And on there, you'll get links to everything I'm now about to tell you about, right off of Bregin.com. Empathictherapy.org, or .com, but empathictherapy.org, is our 501c3, that is a nonprofit approved by the federal government, nonprofit organization. We hold a conference April 13th through 15th. If you want to support us, join the conference by going to empathictherapy.org. You'll meet me and my wife Ginger and hear our presentations, but you'll hear 30 other people also doing marvelous presentations on two issues: empathic therapies of all kinds for the elderly, for people with dementia, for children, for you and me, for all kinds of folks, variations and different approaches to caring therapies, and two, critiques of drugs, electroshock, and things like that. We're going to have some marvelous panels of people who in fact committed crimes or lost a loved one because of psychiatric drugs. Fascinating, heart-rending panels last year. We're going to have new panels of a similar kind this year. So we cover the waterfront of what's good and what's bad in the mental health profession. If you go to empathictherapy.org, you can get a free newsletter. We're nearly 3,000 subscribers now for free, and many open it and read it. This is a fabulous newsletter, at least every month, put out by my wife, Ginger. And, of course, I help with it, but she puts it out, and it's a fabulous newsletter with very interesting materials, you can stay up to date on the latest good things in psychiatry and the latest criticism. No better than by getting our empathic therapy newsletter. My two most recent books are, what are they? Metagazing Madness. That's a popular mass market book. And my medical book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition. And I also have a training film on how to do empathic therapy that you can get on Bregan.com, the empathic therapy training film on Bregan.com. So that's it, sir. Ted, it's been a fabulous interview.
Well, I thank you so much. It's been really good having you on. And I know there's a lot of people that are sitting back now scratching their heads saying, oh, my God, I didn't know this before. So, and I really appreciate you coming on. Dr. Peter Bregan, thank you so much, and I hope to have you back real soon.